This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Our guest, Brian Hare, did some groundbreaking research that demonstrated that dogs and people have something in common. They both understand what is meant by a pointing finger. That gesture can reveal a lot about intelligence. Brian Hare is an evolutionary anthropologist at Duke University, co-author of a new book called The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. He's been studying dogs' unique kind of social intelligence and their ability to adapt to the human environment. Often referred to as man's best friend, Hare says a dog's friendly nature allowed them to domesticate themselves. Brian Hare is founder of the Duke Canine Cognition Center, co-founder of Dognition.com, and joins us from the studios of Duke University. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Oh, my goodness gracious. How much coffee have you had this morning?
I'm ready.
You're ready to go.
I'm excited.
Me too. Woo-hoo. We're talking about my favorite subject, which happens to be dogs. Let me begin with this this pointing behavior and why that, how that works with dogs and why that's significant. And you write about an experiment you did with your dog, Oreo. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. So what happened was I was an undergraduate and my advisor and I were doing some research comparing how chimpanzees and human infants are either similar or different in how they think. And what we discovered was that chimpanzees are not very good at using human gestures, whereas human infants are really good and they become really good at understanding the gestures of adults, et cetera, right when they start acquiring language. So my advisor said, well, hey, this must be something really important that allows us to be human. And it was at that time, and he really thought it might be unique to our species. And so then I said, as an undergraduate, well, I think my dog can do that. And so then,
which was true, so then, actually, right?
Well, it ended up being true, but, you know, he was, you know, a good scientist and said, well, you know, everybody says their dog can do calculus. So if we want to figure this out, you know, if you're serious, we need to do some experiments. So that's what we did. So I went home to my parents' house and the first publication was on my two pet dogs in my parents' house, and we did all the work in my parents' garage.
And what you did was by pointing, the dog was very, your dog, and I guess all dogs are very attuned to human beings pointing at something and the kind of intention, I guess, associated with that.
Yeah, so the idea is that, you know, we gesture to each other all the time, you know, trying to help each other find things. You know, if you're going to give somebody directions, the first thing you'll do besides try to tell them is you'll point. And point them in the direction they need to go. And so that's what dogs are really good at, is understanding those types of gestures relative to other animals.
And does that mean that they know this instinctively? For instance, can you see this in puppies?
Well, that was one of the big surprises, because we thought that, you know, of course, dogs, what might make them different and why they're so good at this relative to other species is they spend thousands of hours with us. And, you know, we're constantly trying to tell them, help them or boss them around. And maybe they just learn this slowly over time. And, you know, it's nothing that is particularly special, except for that they have a lot of experience with people. And so we went and looked at little puppies, and it ends up that even 6 to 9 week old puppies are really, really good at this. Hmm. And that was one of the big shockers. They seem to be prepared for this.
Well, and what's interesting, so this is what dogs and humans have in common, this understanding of what it means to point to something.
Yeah, so this is one of the things that really makes dogs special. Yep.
And obviously they're looking at us. They're looking at our face. They're looking at our bodies. They're looking at our movements. I mean, all of this is, they are computing and calculating what it is that we're trying to tell them.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And so, you know, if you're, one of the things we talk about in The Genius of Dogs, the book, is, you know, essentially we've learned more in the last 10 years than we had in the previous century about mm-hmm. how dogs think. And one of the things we review is how actually dogs are pretty vapid when it comes to their understanding of the non-social world. So imagine a dog as a physicist. It's just not going to happen. They don't understand physics very well. And so they compensate for their weaknesses by relying on the most powerful tool that has ever, you know, been created by nature, which is the human mind. And so they're constantly using us to help them solve problems, and it makes them really super powerful relative to other non-human animals.
And you call this making inferences, which I guess is something that, that humans do as well.
Yeah, so this is one of the things that we talk about, again, in The Genius of Dogs, is that when we think about intelligence from a scientific perspective, what we're really talking about and what we're really interested in is, are animals capable of putting two things together based on an inference? Is it that they can, having never seen a problem before, spontaneously solve it and in a sort of creative and new way? And the answer is there's lots of evidence that animals make inferences. Mm. And, you know, dogs are no exception.
But do chimps and bonobos, do they make inferences?
Oh, absolutely. So chimpanzees and bonobos are our two closest relatives. Chimpanzees are famous because of their work with Jane Good, you know, because of Jane Goodall, right, and all her work. And bonobos are famous because they're the only ape that doesn't kill other apes of their own kind, and of course for their sexual behavior. But they have very complex cognitive lives. They make inferences, and in fact, in many ways, they can make more flexible decisions than most other animals on the planet. But the exception is when it comes to cooperating and communicating with people. Hmm. And that's where dogs can run circles around them.
Well, and probably literally.
literally.
Do that as well.
Wagging their tail, taunting them as they do it.
Exactly. But going back to the chimps and bonobos, so if you were to point, if there were like a ball underneath a cup, which I know you've done this experiment with dogs, if you were to point to something, the chimp or bonobo would not understand what you were doing or saying to them?
That's right. Well, it's amazing because, you know, we have all sorts of evidence that chimpanzees and bonobos can work together to solve right. problems. They can deceive one another. They have this really complex social life. But when you do this really, really simple basic game, which is you hide something in one of two places, like a ball or a piece of food, and then you just try to tell them where it is, they are absolutely flummoxed. And I've spent, you know, weeks of my life trying to figure out why and trying to help them find things, and they just really, really struggle. Dogs, on the other hand, spontaneously, and again, just even as little puppies, 6 to 9 weeks old, they are masterful at this. And it's not just because they can smell what's hidden. It's really they're using the information we're giving them.
You describe it as survival of the friendliest, if we're going to understand, which I love, I have to say. But if we're going to understand dogs' evolution and how they got to be where they are today, we have to understand that in terms of their social ability.
Yeah, and so I think that a lot of people, when you think of evolution, you know, there's this idea that nature is red in tooth and claw, and that the only way to get ahead is through, you know, beating your competitor, and you have to, you know, outcompete them through aggression and through violence, et cetera. But actually, when you step back and you look at nature, what you learn is that there are lots and lots and lots of species that have been successful by actually evolving to be really friendly and by being more tolerant and by being highly social, and that allows them to cooperate and to work together in a way that other species can't, and then they end up winning the day. And that's what dogs did. That's exactly the story of where dogs come from and how they've been so successful.
And beginning as wolves, how many thousands of years ago?
Well, so the best estimates are probably somewhere between 15,000 and 40,000 years ago, a population of wolves basically said, you know what? I love hunting, but you know what's even better than hunting is eating garbage and human garbage. And so that's when we think it all started.
And the idea of if you like human garbage, you have to get closer to humans. You have to begin to, eat, if not interact with them, at least get closer to their encampments?
That's right. So you have to be willing to be friendly, to be less aggressive, and to be interested in humans. And so the wolves in that original in those populations that made this decision to be near humans, they had to be those friendly, non-aggressive, tolerant, and group of wolves. And so that's what got this all started.
So when you talk about dogs domesticating themselves, is that what you're referring to then?
Absolutely. So it's not the case that people went out and said, hey, you know what? Our number one competitor is the wolf. The other major predator that we're competing against are wolves. Hey, why don't we go get some and have some in our camps. And wouldn't it be fun to just feed them? And we can just, you know, give them some of our food and, you know, always have wolves around. I really don't think that's very likely. The key thing to understand is domestication requires genetic evolution. So that means a heritable change, and it takes many generations for genes to change. And so if people intentionally domesticated wolves, that meant that they were keeping and growing wolves into adulthood, breeding them and doing this for many, many generations. And that's just not a very plausible explanation for where dogs come from.
I mean, that's a very human-centric view of evolution. You're saying that it was really the dogs that were doing this, not the humans.
Yes. So basically what happened is as humans became more sedentary, which happens about 15 to 12,000 years ago, there's garbage everywhere. And what are humans eating? They're eating the exact same thing that that wolves eat. It had to be absolutely irresistible. And those wolves that had the courage and the tolerance to, you know, take advantage of this new, really reliable resource, they are winning big time. And what we know is that when you start having individuals breeding together that are really friendly, they have all sorts of morphological changes. And I think what happened was humans were able to pick up on the morphological changes and know these are the wolves that are friendly and eat garbage, and these are the ones that are, you know, still running around being competitors with us.
And do you think cuteness works in evolution?
Well, what we know is that when you select canids, so relatives of dogs, so let's say foxes, to be friendly towards people, they become cuter. They end up by accident. You don't actually intentionally make them cuter, but they become cuter by accident. So they have floppy ears and curly tails. And so I think what happened was dogs started eating garbage and hanging around people. And just as an accident of how the genes work, they got really cute. And, you know, people couldn't help but be more tolerant of them.
Well, that's interesting. We're almost having a break here, but the idea of floppy ears and perhaps that, you know, cute little puppy face, that was part of evolution and part of the beginning of this relationship between dogs and humans.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And so I think that that's what sort of protected dogs as they changed from wolves to proto dogs. I think that's one of the things that people use to know that, hey, wait, this isn't the aggressive one. This is the one that's actually, you know, friendly and barks when strangers come by and sort of protects us, et cetera. And we can be tolerant of them being around. Whereas if it was a wolf, you know, we're not interested in them being around.
And that's Brian Hare, our guest today on Radio Times, co-author with Vanessa Woods of a new book called The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. He's an evolutionary anthropologist, founder of the Duke Canine Cognition Center, co-founder of Dognition.com, joins us from the studios of Duke University. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Any questions you have or comments you might even have about dogs and dog evolution and their smartness, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
PICO supports WHYY. The PICO Smart Business e-Audit is an online tool that analyzes and estimates business energy usage and provides customized recommendations to help manage energy consumption. Find more at pico.com/smartideas.
I'm Marty Moscowane. It's the sixth day of the winter membership drive here at WHYY, and we're asking for your pledge of support. We thank the thousands of you who have contributed to our news and information service over the years. You can hear your investment on the air in the programs that you enjoy. If you haven't become a member yet, do it now and call 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Today on Radio Times, an hour's discussion of the financial crisis and what can be done to reform the system and get people back to work. Our guest is Princeton University's Alan Blinder, author of After the Music Stop. Then another hour's discussion with evolutionary anthropologist Brian Hare on his groundbreaking research on dogs and intelligence. Where else can you hear that kind of in-depth, diverse interview? Only on Radio Times at WHYY. Make a call, 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks.
The Oriental Rug Room at 10,000 Villages in Ephrata supports WHYY, now hosting their annual rug event, featuring the Fairtrade Bunyad rug collection of over 1,500 hand-knotted rugs. Online at rugs.10,000villages.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. If you're just joining us, Brian Hare is our guest. He's been researching social intelligence in dogs. In fact, he's the founder of the Duke University Cognition Center, author, co-author of a new book called The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. And we are talking about some of his ideas and experiences and research in his new book. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So, Brian, do you think that domestication or self-domestication, as you describe it, has made dogs smarter?
Yes. So, basically, I mean, the way that I think we traditionally think about genius or intelligence is that you either sort of have more or less of it, and there's really kind of one measure. And I think part of the reason we think that is because everybody has to take these standardized tests. You get a number. It's either a high number or a low number. You look around at your friends. Oh, you know, I didn't do as well as them, or I did better than them. Ha, ha, ha. And that's sort of how we think about intelligence. But unfortunately, that's just not how it works. So what we've discovered by taking a cognitive approach and by taking an evolutionary approach is there are lots of different types of intelligence. And that you can have a real strength in one, and that doesn't mean that you have a strength in all of them. And so that's really what we've discovered, is that different species have different strengths. They have intelligences where they are really remarkable, and then in other types of intelligence, they're really quite weak. And so dogs are case in point, where they are absolute geniuses when it comes to using humans as tools, reading the information that we provide them with our gestures, in fact, very quickly learning words and what they refer to. But then they're really, really quite vapid in some other areas. But they use that social skill to overcome their weaknesses. And so I think, you know, not only is that a helpful way to think about dogs, it's also a helpful way to think about intelligence in general.
Well, interestingly, you say that dogs are the most successful mammal on the planet after human beings.
Well, it's hard to contest that. They are in every corner of the planet. And while we had a horrible recession and lots of people have been suffering worldwide, dogs are doing great. They have more jobs than ever. And in fact, it's hard to find a dog to fill all the jobs we need their help with.
I'm thinking of those bumper stickers that you see in the back of people's cars saying, you know, my child is an honor student. Are we going to see bumper stickers saying, my dog is a genius?
Well, I mean, so just to quickly tell people that I think that one of the exciting things that's occurred. So we've written a book, The Genius of Dogs,
right.
And that really helps. That helps people understand all the scientific discoveries. We've reviewed everything that we know scientifically about dog intelligence in the book, but there's even more than that now because of this revolution in our understanding, and that's what is so exciting about dognition.com. And that's where people can actually participate in science-based games with their dog and find out what's their dog's cognitive style. And they can participate and be part of the science that we're doing right now.
And I'm assuming different breeds bring out different qualities in a dog. And, of course, there are many mixed breeds as well.
So that's really a fun, exciting question that everybody asks me. But as a scientist, I have good news and bad news. If you feel really strongly there's a breed difference, well, nobody can contradict you using science. But also, there's no scientific support.
Really?
And that's, again, yes. And think about the problem. There's 177 AKC breeds. There are and if I wanted to understand one cognitive trait, let's say memory, does it differ between the breeds? I'd need 50 to 100 individuals per breed. But I can't, as a scientist, possibly test that many dogs in my own, you know, career. So this is where dognition.com is going to be absolutely revolutionary. If everybody gets excited and as a community we can work together to do this citizen science project, we'll be able to answer questions about breed differences, because you with your own dog can play fun science-based games and figure out – how your dog is thinking and how it's thinking relative to others. And you'll learn about your own dog and enrich your own relationship. But at the same time, you're going to be contributing to this citizen science project. And scientists like myself are going to be able to go in and say, wow, let's look for breed differences. Is it that Chihuahuas have better memory than Great Danes, et cetera?
Well, and I'm thinking of all the working dogs that we see and learn about, from guide dogs, people with disabilities that have dogs that help them navigate the world, search and rescue dogs. Of course, all the military dogs, even going into Osama bin Laden's hideout in Abbottabad, Pakistan, there was a military dog that went in with the special forces.
Well, so that's one of the missions of the Duke Canine Cognition Center, is to understand dog psychology better, to not only just understand how the origin of dogs, but also dogs have a lot of jobs, and there's a huge demand for dogs in the military, but also to help kids who are trying to go to school but are having seizures, and dogs can actually help them prevent those seizures. Or autistic children, who actually many children who are paired with a dog do a lot better at school and in other social settings. And we can just – the list just goes on and on, everything from bombs to detecting bed bugs. And so we've been involved in trying to help figure out how to get dogs prepared more quickly and more effectively for all these different jobs. And that's part of what people can now participate in through dognition.com.
But would you say that we are maybe at the very beginning of a revolution, or at least a research revolution when it comes to dogs, which is interesting to contemplate considering how closely we've lived with these animals for so many centuries?
Well, I think that was part of the problem, is that some scientists, of course, had dogs, and it was, it just seemed like, it's a dog. There's nothing really remarkable about a dog. Why would you study a dog? But it ends up that they're one of the most important species we could study. And so I think there's a lot of energy now within, the different life sciences to start investigating how the mind of the dog works. And so I think people are going to really enjoy learning all these things. But again, what we're so excited to be able to do is give people the chance to participate and through the Citizen Science Project on dognition.com.
Is there any way to know how dogs, and this is speaking generally, of course, how dogs think about or even view human beings? I mean, do they like us?
That's really fun. So I'm going to answer that in two ways. I'm going to tell you the studies that have been done, and then I'm going to tell you how you can find out about your own dog. So the first is that a fascinating study was done by Adam McCloskey's group in Hungary, where basically he gave them the choice between spending time with a strange dog or giving dogs a chance to spend time with a strange human. And dogs had a huge preference, overwhelming preference, to hang out with the human and not the strange dog. So if you ask dogs, actually, they prefer to hang out with us over even their own kind. So they love humans, especially if they've been socialized and raised by people. Now, what about your own dog? Well, one of the things that you'll be able to do at dognition.com is measure your dog's empathy relative to other dogs' empathy. Because what happens is, we provide you with these games. You then play these games with your dog. You let us know what your dog did. And then we have algorithms that will let you know how your dog compares to all the other dogs. And you'll find out, is your dog one that has a lot of empathy, is really strongly bonded to you, or is your dog one that's a little bit more independent doesn't really rely on empathy to sort of navigate its social world?
And how much does food figure into the relationship between humans and dogs?
Well, I think that food had to be where it all got started.
Exactly.
And certainly, dogs love food just like any other animal. If they're smart, they don't bite the hand that feeds them. I think there's more going on here than just food rewards. I think that actually dogs have evolved to find interacting with humans itself very rewarding, and the interaction itself is the reward.
I've lived with cats and dogs, and it's so interesting because cats, at least my cats, would never look me in the eye. They always had to look away, whereas a dog has that just intense eye contact. It's really quite striking.
Well, this is actually one of the games on dognation.com, because what we found is that when dogs stare at you like that, it actually is releasing oxytocin in your brain, which is the hug hormone. So that's the hormone that makes you feel very social. And dogs staring deeply into your eyes essentially makes you, feel very social towards that dog. And basically in the studies that have been done with people, it's more relaxing than reading a book or watching television if you hang out, interact with your dog, and they stare in your eyes.
And how important is eye contact then for dogs as the recipient of that? If I'm staring, if I'm looking at my dog.
Yeah, so I think that they what they get is because you have this uptick in your oxytocin, then you, of course, are going to want to pet and interact with them, and then that makes them feel great.
And I'm saying, oh, you're such a good boy. I mean, things like that.
I mean, how could they not love that? Come on. They're a dog.
Exactly. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. I do want to get some callers in. Brian Hare, our guest, co-author of a new book called The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. And he's an evolutionary anthropologist at Duke University. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me just pick up on that. I mean, how much does the inflection in our voice or even the words that we use, how much are dogs computing that information, do you think, Brian?
Well, this is one of the things we review in The Genius of Dogs. There's some great work on this, basically showing that when you use sort of the high-pitched motherese voice, the, oh, you're so cute, oh, I love you, that actually dogs really pick up on that. They know that you're happy with them. They know that you are interested in paying attention to them. Whereas if you have the deep voice, oh, you were really bad, whatever, then that's something that they know is aversive. And those, just using those different voices is enough for them to figure out if they're in trouble or not. So they're quite – they're quite responsive to that. And in fact, if you're trying to communicate with your dog, we review studies in The Genius of Dogs showing that when you're gesturing to them, if you use a high-pitched voice, that they're much more sensitive to what you're trying to tell them.
Sort of like kids, babies, right?
Absolutely. Again, very similar to human infants.
Let me get looks like Mike from Yardley to join our conversation. And Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning,
good
Ryan.
Morning.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
I could talk to you guys for hours, but the producers
told
me
that.
To.
No, you can't do that, Mike. Yes.
A couple of things. This came up while I was listening. I have retrievers, and they much prefer a toy to food. They would play and wait and eat later, But the questions I have for Brian are, one, I've been convinced by the recent materials that I've come associated with or acquainted with that the human and the dog co-domesticated. That is, it happened at the same time, and that it's as fair to say that dogs domesticated humans as it is to say that humans domesticated dogs. The other question I have is, I think that process took place before they came in to eat garbage. I think it was happening as a cooperative hunting strategy.
Well, Mike,
and that it took place over many years.
Well, Mike, let me see what Brian here thinks about some of your theories. What do you think, Brian?
Well, we talk about the self-domestication of humans in The Genius of Dogs as well. And here's the idea. The idea is that humans actually, for the majority of our history as a species, since about 500,000 years ago until about 12,000 years ago, where we change from about 12,000 years ago, we start relying on agriculture. Before that, we were foragers. There was no agriculture. So before 12,000 years ago, there's nothing to store. There's nothing that we rely on other than what we can produce each day. So basically, dogs starting to follow us around and to be close to us, that actually was one of the things that probably started making us more tolerant. And so, you know, could have led to the fact that we were able to then settle and to live in higher density and to be friendlier to each other. Because to take advantage of the benefit of having dogs nearby, we had to be friendlier and nicer. And that may have led us to be friendlier and nicer to each other.
Mike, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But Brian, sometimes we hear about dogs that have symptoms of anxiety or even obsessive compulsive disorder. And I sometimes wonder whether that is a kind of price, if not of domestication, but of living, you know, in a 21st century world where dogs are often kept inside. They can't roam free the way they did, you know, thousands or maybe hundreds of years ago.
So what's interesting is that, first of all, if you were to compare the emotional reactivity of dogs to most other animals, I think this is a really key point, is that dogs are domesticated and there's been genetic change that actually makes them less emotionally reactive as a species than almost any other species on the planet. The reason that, you know, you can't take a chimpanzee or a bonobo and make it a pet is because they have an emotional reactive system that makes it impossible. They get so aggressive and so upset in certain contexts that it would be dangerous to have them as pets. A dog, on the other hand, they have this emotional system that makes them very chill and relaxed around us and non-aggressive. So that doesn't mean, though, that some dogs aren't, you know, more anxious than other dogs. And I think that's what you're seeing when you're talking about some dogs having anxiety disorders.
And whether, I mean, whether they're just picking up from the conditions that they're living in, or whether they're not getting the kind of exercise or care and love.
So this is where Dognition.com can really help. And, you know, what you have to understand is science is limited by the tools we have to do research. And in the past, we just really haven't had the tools to understand the big picture of why some dogs are anxious and other dogs aren't. So what we'll be able to do through Dognition.com is you will find out your dog's cognitive style. We're going to help you evaluate five different types of intelligence. But then we'll be able to ask you questions about, well, how did you raise your dog? Is your dog trained? Is your dog anxious? And then we'll be able to see, are there certain cognitive styles that are related to the anxiety that we see in some dogs? And that'll help us as scientists figure out how we can help dogs and how we can potentially intervene on some of these issues that, you know, we struggle to deal with, like anxiety.
I always breaks my heart when I see a dog that's chained up outside, and there are dogs that essentially do live chained up outside, only because they are so social and they seem to be so much wanting to be part of our worlds. Are they lonely, bored under those conditions? Do you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that, you know, I mean, dogs evolve to be with each other, but even more importantly, to be with people. And so, you know, chaining up a dog is a bad idea for many reasons. One is the dog is lonely. But the other thing we review in The Genius of Dogs is that, you know, again, dogs are not very good at understanding the principles of physics. And here's a specific example of that, where dogs don't understand connectivity, that when things are connected, that, you know, they move in concert together. So, you know, take the example of you're walking your dog down the street on a leash. There's a lamppost coming. If you are walking with a human, you know, on a leash, well, they would know they have to, the two humans have to be on the same side to go around the lamppost.
Right.
Well, dogs don't understand that. And so, you know, you'll end up wrapped around the lamppost very quickly with a dog. And so when you have a dog on a chain or on, you know, any kind of thing like that, they're going to be confused. And that's why you don't want to keep them on a chain.
And that's Brian Hare, our guest today on Radio Times. He's an evolutionary anthropologist at Duke University, co-author of a new book called The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. Just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling depressed, anxious? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of natural supplements to treat the symptoms of depression or anxiety. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for treatment. To learn more about Penn Medicine's Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit, 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're in the middle of the winter membership campaign here at WHYY, and we hope to end the drive by the end of the week. We will only do that with your pledge of support. If your membership has lapsed, if you're new to the area, perhaps you're new to WHYY and public broadcasting, take that next step and make a pledge of support. You decide what this service is worth and then call 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. You can get a special Radio Times anniversary mug designed by our very own award-winning Tony Off for just a pledge of $60. We host 500 hour-long interviews every year on Radio Times, something for everyone. Today we're talking about the roots of the financial crisis with Princeton University's Alan Blinder and about dogs' intelligence with evolutionary anthropologist Brian Hare. Where else do you hear those kinds of interviews? Make a pledge, 1-888-345-9499. Thanks so much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Brian Hare. He's a dog researcher, an evolutionary anthropologist, founder of the Duke Canine Cognition Center, co-author of a new book called The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Brian, when a dog looks in the mirror, do we know what they think they see?
So this is a really fun one. So do dogs understand when they know something or when they don't know something? And do dogs have sort of self-awareness? Do they know that they're sort of an individual in the world, different from other individuals? So this is really a tough one for science to come up with some really nice, rigorous tests. But right now, the answer is that this is a place where dogs probably do not know what they don't know, mm-hmm. and probably are not, when they look in the mirror, understanding that they are something that's mm-hmm. different than other dogs. And that's where great apes, for instance, chimpanzees and bonobos, they certainly recognize themselves in mirrors and know what they don't know. So that's where dogs probably aren't remarkable.
And underscoring those different kinds of intelligences that we've been talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. So what makes dogs remarkable is their ability to use humans as social tools and, to compensate for some of their weaknesses by depending on us.
Let me see what Alan from Pottstown has to say. Alan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Morty and Brian.
Go ahead, Alan.
Alan from Pottstown, PA. I've been trained as a dog behavioral therapist by Barkbusters. Have you ever heard of Barkbusters, Brian?
Barkbusters?
I don't think so, no.
Well, we were trained that dogs react to the system that they're living in, and they, by nature, are pack animals. And a pack needs a good, strong leader that will provide the four basic needs for dogs, which is food, safety, shelter, and entertainment. Does any of that make sense to you?
Does that make sense to you, Brian?
Well, so the premise that dogs, that there's an alpha dog and that dogs have a social system like wolves, where there are two dominant individuals in the pack that are the leaders, and everybody follows those two leaders, and they use aggression to sort of suppress the rest of the members of the group. Now, that is the wolf social system. Right. But what we found by looking at feral dogs that don't depend on humans, that's not the dog's social system at all. In fact, how dogs decide who to follow is not based on who's the most aggressive. That has little impact on who they follow. Who they follow is the individual with the most friends and the most affiliative relationship. So I think the idea that that you have to be alpha over your dog or whatever, it just, when you look at the science, it doesn't pan out.
The idea being alpha being the person in charge versus the person who's loving.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we use the natural behavior of dogs when humans are not there, they don't really have a very strict hierarchy, and they do not follow a dominant alpha dog in the group. They follow the one with the most friends. So if we use that as an analogy, well, in our own relationships with dogs, if we want them to follow us and, you know, for us to be the leader, we just need to be friendly and great, great. affiliative relationships.
And when it comes to dog, and I'm using quotation marks here, training, then the idea of rewards and positive praise, things like that, is more effective than negative reinforcement?
Well, this is one of the fun things that we've learned as well, is that when you look at the idea that, you know, a lot of people would argue that training is about a lot of elbow grease, that more is better. So certainly, you know, using reward and praise while you're working with your dog is very, very important. But I think there's another underlying assumption that you have to work really hard and you have to train constantly, and the more you train, the better. But the truth is, when we look at the science, it's actually quite the opposite. You can overtrain a dog and make it harder on yourself if you work with them too much. And in fact, in many cases, less is more. So if you train your dog less often for shorter periods of time, what we've seen is they learn faster.
Interesting. Let me get, looks like Mina from Beverly to join us. And Mina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. I just have a question about, well, basically my question is whether there's a scientific explanation for what I've seen to be the difference in personalities between different breeds. I have labs now who are very affectionate and sweet. In the past, I've had Huskies who are very kind of emotionally independent, I guess is the word, way to describe it. And I was just wondering if there was a scientific explanation or basis for that.
Mina, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Brian, what do you think?
Well, again, this is where I think if people get excited about being citizen scientists, we can really answer this question. So what we've done at DogNation.com is come up with 10 games people can play. And they measure different intelligence. So things like empathy and communication and the ability of the dogs to be cunning and their memory and their ability to reason. And so what we'll be able to do if people decide to learn about their dog's own cognitive style and also participate and help us learn more about dogs is we can answer questions like that. Right now, that's a tough question for us to look at breed differences. But if people go and play all these games, we'll see that, you know, wow, your two dogs, one of them is really amazing when it comes to their memory and their ability to use gestures, whereas your other one is really relying on empathy and cunning. And that may help us understand why they are the way that they are. I think the key thing to understand, though, is that dogs are definitely individuals. And just like people, they have different types of intelligence they rely on.
Mina, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Brian, when you talk about, as you're title of your book is The Genius of Dogs. Genius, of course, is a loaded word. What do you mean by genius?
Well, so what I think that the way that we traditionally think of genius is that, you know, you take a standardized test and the person who was, you know, three standard deviations above or basically just does amazing relative to everybody else, that's the genius. But how we think about genius is very different, which is that we take for granted that dogs are geniuses because they're all over the planet and they're so successful in so many jobs. And, you know, as a species, they've just been remarkable. So, you know, really the question is, how are they designed by nature? How did they evolve so that they could be so successful? And so when you look at dogs relative to other species, that's how you can determine their genius. What was it that makes them special? How do they outperform other species? And that must be what makes them so successful. So that's really how we think about it, is relative to other species. And then, of course, any case where an animal can make an inference, that's what we think of as being genius.
And have you always lived with dogs?
Oh, yeah, always. You know, ever since I was a kid, you know, my best friend growing up was definitely my dog, yeah. Oreo, and have had dogs my whole life, of course, yeah.
Of course. myself as well. Let me get
you, so you understand. And what's your corgi's name?
Charlie.
And how old is Charlie?
Charlie's old. He's 15.
He's pushing it. Wow. So you've done a great job taking care of Charlie then.
He's a great little guy. What can I say? I'll start crying if I think about
Well, we don't want
Charlie.
You crying. No, okay,
no,
okay.
Exactly. Let me get Colleen from Bryn Mawr to join us. And Colleen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Brian. It's nice to speak to you. I'm hoping that you can solve a problem in our house with our yellow lab named Blue. We had a yellow lab scout for 12 years prior to Blue, who is now 2 years old, both yellow labs. The argument in our home, I have two teenagers, a 16-year-old son, a 19-year-old daughter, my husband, and myself. The argument is, who's the dog's favorite? She's spoiled. She's terribly spoiled. I walk her for 2 miles every day. My husband comes home from work and takes her out back. We have a fairly large property and runs with the dog outside and plays with her for a while. My son comes home from school and wrestles and plays with her, and she loves it. And my daughter just coddles the dog and hugs her and gives her the people treats that I forbid everybody to give her.
Lucky dog.
Yeah, she's spoiled rotten. She's adorable. That's what saves her. We're trying to, and we always have an argument. Who does she like best?
Is there a test for that, Brian?
There is actually. It's actually quite simple, which is that if you think of a triangle, the dog is at the tip of the triangle, and then you have say your daughter and you at the feet of the triangle, and basically you just both of you call your dog at the same time.
Oh dear!
And just see who does your dog go to more often.
We try that. In fact, when we lay in bed, she's in the hallway, and we call her, and she just lays down.
Oh, she's not going to play that game. She loves all of you. Your dog is a genius.
Right. I want to meet this dog. Like
yeah, me too. That's great. Well, Colleen, I would say enjoy your yellow lab named Blue.
Thank you, and I'm enjoying the show thoroughly, and as is my husband from his car. He's the one who called and asked me to turn it on. You guys are fantastic.
Oh,
thank you, and I'm looking forward to purchasing your book.
Thank you for the question.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Colleen.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Brian, let me go back to just some more research that's in your book having to do with this pointing and eye contact. You've also found that when people turn their back on a dog and they tell them not to do something or to do something, if you turn your back, chances are that dog is going to sneak and you know, in a sense, misbehave literally behind your back.
Right. So, I mean, I think one of the other things, some people had called in and asked about training. One of the other things that we learn by taking a cognitive approach to dog psychology is that they're not just always just sitting there trying to please us. They also have their own agenda.
Yes.
And they're using their social understanding of us to sometimes get away with some things. And so that's what people have basically been able to demonstrate scientifically is there are some dogs, and as a species, dogs are capable of they basically can tell when you can see them, either based on whether your back is turned or even if your eyes are open or closed.
Yes.
So and they will sort of be sneaky. They're more likely to sneak things when your eyes are closed or your back is turned.
So are they kind of a unique combination of empath and psychopath?
Well, I don't know if they're psychopaths. I mean, you know, there would be a lot of people that fit that description too. So
indeed.
I think they're just clever. I think they're just not going to do everything we want all the time.
Let me get Bruce from looks like Horsham to join us on Radio Times. Hey, Bruce, go ahead. You're on the air. Whoops, that would be number one. We'll get Bruce squared away. Do we have Bruce? Yeah, go ahead, Bruce.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
I have a Siberian Husky who seems very reminiscent of a wolf in her behavior. She howls like a wolf, and she curls up with her tail, with her head under her tail, and just seems to be very, very similar to a wolf. I'm wondering if that's the closest link to the wolf in the dog species.
Bruce, thanks for the call. Brian, do you have an answer to that?
Bruce, fun question. So it ends up that, of course, wolves are the closest living relative of dogs. Genetically, really relative to most other species that are different from one another, the genetic differences are indistinguishable. It's a few tenths of a percentage, which is nothing, really. But that being said, what's fun is that there are 9 breeds of dogs that are more genetically wolf-like than all other breeds of dogs. And the Husky is one of them. It's a question to how they became genetically more wolf-like. Is it that it was because they haven't changed as much as other breeds of dogs from wolves, or have they some Huskies have been interbred with wolves? But there are 9 breeds, and the Husky is one of them that is more wolf-like genetically.
Bruce, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get, looks like Ronnie from Malvern, Pennsylvania, to join our conversation. And Ronnie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. This is a great topic.
Thanks.
I am a little wary of dogs. But I am actually a pediatrician, and I'm constantly counseling parents on being, you know, careful with their kids around dogs. And it just absolutely terrifies me, like when my friends or relatives or neighbors, they have, you know, little babies that are 1.5 years old, and they're letting them run around at the same time where the dog is there, no gates and that sort of thing. How do dogs, and nothing happens. So, like, how do dogs know not to hurt children, and are there certain breeds that are better?
That's a great question, Ronnie. Brian, do you have an answer?
Well, that is a fantastic question. And, you know, I would be lying if I could tell you the explanation for why dogs are, in general, really, really good with little kids. Because it's true. Little kids in particular, they tend to be much more tolerant of and a little bit more careful with. But there are, of course, lots of examples. And as a pediatrician, you would not be doing your job if you weren't worried, because here's the sad fact, which is, as a culture or as a society, we tend to blame certain breeds for aggression problems. So, say the bull terrier breeds, the American pit bull. But the truth is that when you look at the published papers, pit bulls are no more responsible for problems than any other breed. And the number one pattern that stands out, and the number one thing to be worried about, is young toddlers, especially boys, who are at home with their own dog, at their own pet dog, when parents are not watching or not around. Huh. That is the most likely situation for a serious injury to occur. So I think even though we trust our dogs, and even though dogs are really, really good around children, you want to avoid for them having unsupervised play together, because even the most wonderful dog that's never done anything can make a mistake.
Interesting. Ronnie, appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Brian Hare, appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Oh, this has been a great pleasure. Thank you, Marty. I hope you have a wonderful time with your dog at home.
Indeed, I will, and I do, and to you as well, Brian. Brian Hare, our guest, dog researcher, evolutionary anthropologist, founder of the Duke Canine Cognition Center, co-author of The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think, and co-founder of Dognition.com. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.